This is Fully Vested, a weekly podcast where Jason Rowley and Graham Peck discuss technology and venture capital investing. This week, we discuss the future of surveillance culture and expectation of privacy, especially as it relates to facial recognition AI. The show was recorded on January 19th. You can learn more at fullyvested.co.
Hey, Jason, how's it going?
Pretty good there, Graham. Can't really complain, except for the fact that there is a... the L continues to be very loud behind my...
I can hear it.
You can?
Yeah, just very slightly.
Oh, no. Well, yeah. Listeners, this is the sort of podcasting verite that I go for. You get the lovely sound of Chicago's elevated train from many, many stories below me, filtering through my window and into your ears.
Well, that's just a benefit, isn't it? I mean, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, anybody who's made the grave mistake of listening to this while trying to go to bed, you know, they could mistake the low rumble for some thunder in the background. You know, I hear that's a really good, you know, sound to play while trying to go to sleep. But yeah, you get the big squeaky, screechy, metal snake that flows through Chicago, right below me.
I just turned off my laundry, so that we could record, because I can't, both run my dryer and record a podcast at the same time.
Cause all the zippers, hit against the metal drum of the dryer, and you'll just hear like, you know, clicks and taps, all day.
Yep, absolutely. Mm. And actually I think I might have a problem with a bearing or something. Cause it's actually getting a little squeaky the last few loads. Mm-mm. So,
oh no.
Yeah. It's not good.
Don't want a squeaky
it's
bearing.
Not good. No.
Mm. Yeah. Ah. Good Lord. Anyways, Graham, happy Sunday to you. What?
Ooh. Let's see if I can not choke on my this week's San Pellegrino blood orange.
Yeah. All right. Sounds fair. You know, Graham, before we get into what we're talking about today, which for the record is primarily focused on this article published in the New York Times about a certain company called Clearview, which uses facial recognition technology, plus its massive corpus of photos and other images and such that it has scraped from around the internet to help identify people in like security camera photos and other sorts of situations. We, Graham, should probably tell people who we are and what we're doing here, because we've failed to do so the last couple of episodes we've recorded.
Yeah, so if people are confused about who we are in the last couple of episodes, once they come out, then yeah, go back and listen to anything before that or this, and you'll now know who we are. So my name is Graham Peck. I'm a venture partner with a Midwest-based VC called Cultivation Capital. Our group invests in early stage, like seed and series A stage, life sciences technology, ag tech companies, and then specifically the team I'm on is our software technology company or investment fund. We are a St. Louis-based VC, also with offices in LA, and I'm part of our team here in Chicago. In addition to that, I work with startups and larger companies on building their software technology development teams, and I mostly partner with a group out of Eastern Europe called Brightgrove, where we build teams on behalf of our end customers to meet their needs.
Cool.
Jason, who are you?
You know, Graham, I ask myself this question every single day.
Don't we all?
Hey, everybody. that was a slightly longer pause there than I intended. Sorry, everybody. I am not in the middle of going through an existential crisis. At least for now. Graham, oh, what are you going to say?
It will start mid-episode, though, I'm guessing.
Oh, I mean, doesn't it always? Okay, real talk, though. Hey, everybody. My name is Jason Rowley. I'm one of your co-hosts here on Fully Vested. When I'm not doing that, I am a a venture capital data journalist for Crunchbase. And also as a volunteer, I work with the Python Software Foundation to give early stage startups free booth space at PyCon US. And we just closed our applications this past Friday, at least as of time of recording, which is January 19th. So a couple of days ago. Graham, I have a very high quality problem that we can probably discuss offline, which is we have approximately three times as many applicants for the amount of booth space that we've that we have allocated, which is a
Yeah, that's great, because I know that you were a little little nervous or felt a little flat footed. So
as long
as there's quality companies in there, I'm super excited.
Certainly,
for you.
Certainly are. And Graham, you know, you gotta understand a couple of things about me and listeners by proxy. I always feel a little flat footed, mostly because my feet are flat as spatulas. And second, always feeling a little underprepared. But you know what's good is that this application cycle has just proven to me that at the end of the day, a lot of people are kind of like me, and that they procrastinate important things until the absolute last possible minute, and then they get everything submitted more or less on time. So.
Did many of the applications come in just in the hours leading up to the deadline?
In the last like 36 hours before the deadline.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Which is, again, funny. And I'm like, okay, thank God. Although all these, you know, founders are really smart. They also have, you know, human levels of time management skills, which is to say, you know, people procrastinate, which I'm happy about. Because I do, and it makes me feel less guilty.
Yeah, I definitely, like, I don't think I'd get anything done if it wasn't for nearly the last minute. Mm-hmm. So, Jason, do you want to give maybe a little bit of a plug for the upcoming PyCon conference? I think that'd be...
Sure. Oh, sure. Okay, so not a sponsor. Neither. So it's not a sponsor of the show, and not a sponsor of me either, because I do everything... I do for the PSF on a volunteer basis, as does almost everybody else that does any sort of volunteer work around or any sort of work. Volunteer work sort of, in this case, is a bit of a redundant phrase. But anyways, so where am I going? Graham, this is the messiest introduction I think we've ever recorded. But
yeah, that's probably true.
All right. Well, anyways. So, hey, everybody. So PyCon is the world's largest programming conference focused around the Python programming language. It's hosted by the Python Software Foundation. This year, it's taking place in the middle of April in lovely Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It is full of excellent talks and opportunities to connect with the community of Python developers out there. And it is a incredibly welcoming conference experience to everybody of every level of skill. I, for example, can barely code my way out of a wet paper bag, and I am just as welcome there as the core maintainers of the language itself. So I highly recommend it. Anybody who's interested in data science, software engineering, all of the, you know, or just, you know, trying to find a really great community of folks who are interested in those sorts of things, definitely consider either going to a local Python meetup or going to PyCon US. I think tickets are still available.
And I think it looks like it's from Wednesday, April 15th to Thursday, April 23rd. But the main part of the conference, Jason, can you tell us when that is?
Yeah.
And we'll link to the conference website in the show notes.
Yeah, from Friday. So Friday is sort of when everything kicks off more in a sort of formal sense. Friday, Saturday is the main conference. Sunday is the jobs fair. Which obviously, if you're looking for jobs or if you're hiring, a great place to be. And then, you know, after that is follow up to the conference is like sprints. So if you're either an open source project maintainer or a contributor, it's a great opportunity for everybody to meet up in person and jam out on an open source project. And then also, I think if I if I remember the conference itinerary correctly, there's also a sort of closed door language summit for the core maintainers of the programming language itself. So yeah, I'll be there. It'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. And I'm very, very excited in this very long-winded introduction, 10 minutes into recording, to review all of the companies that are applied and to give them free boost space. So, yeah.
Well,
Graham, we are talking about ClearView.
Awesome.
You suggested this as a topic. So I'm going to throw you under the bus and ask you to give a very small synopsis of what this company does, and I will chirp in with other details, and then we can get into a discussion about what this company is, what it means, and our thoughts and feelings about it.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Jason and I have a process, and we haven't really done a meta episode that explains how we record this podcast. That would be, believe it or not, as much as both of us talk, a very short episode, because basically, usually one of us suggests 1 to 3 topics to the other, and this week, kind of spurred on by some research I've seen Jason do in the past, but also one of our conversations a couple of weeks ago, where we talked about some of the kind of upcoming trends. One of the upcoming trends that was identified that we focused in on was that kind of surveillance by companies and the government will become this decade, or has become over the last decade, and will continue to become over this next decade, just kind of every day and very commonplace, and your level of expectation of privacy kind of goes down pretty dramatically. So I happened to find an article this week that I thought was really interesting, and it was all about that. And so I thought we would dive a little deeper into that topic, because I think it's something that's really relevant, to the world today. And I know it's something that Jason again has reported on, and we could kind of cover some of my thoughts from the venture side. So specifically, we are talking about a company called ClearView AI. That was not its original name, but its founder had first founded 2 or 3 startups that kind of failed in different ways, one of which, just kind of for hilarity and reference, was a app that could use augmented reality to place Donald Trump's hairstyle on top of a picture of you. That was one of his failed prior startups. But what ClearView does is they scrape publicly available pictures, although there's some debate about them often violating the terms of use of sites like Facebook, Twitter, Venmo, and others. But they scrape publicly available pictures, and they have created a database of something like 3 billion pictures. And then they allow law enforcement agencies, or maybe even some companies or other end use cases, but primarily what the article focuses on is law enforcement agencies to run a visual search using AI to determine if it's likely that the individual in the search picture matches up with any publicly available and scraped photos that ClearView has found, in their compilation of 3 billion photographs. That number is like something like 10 times the amount, or nearly 10 times the amount of photos that the FBI has available in their search database, at just over 300 million, about 400 million, the article referenced, or some of ClearView's actual sales material had referenced. So basically, that's, we like on this show to talk about a big topic and how technology and the venture capital kind of investing landscape impact a bigger topic oftentimes. And we like to pick a specifically relevant article or two, that are timely to today, as a kind of jumping off point for that. So obviously the bigger topic here is, how should AI and facial recognition be used by government and other sources, moving forward, and what people's expectation of privacy when they post something on the internet, or maybe even are walking down the street, is. And specifically, we'll look at kind of this more recent newsmaker in ClearView as kind of the bellwether for for that, since they are working with a lot of different 600 plus, I think it referenced, law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, Homeland Security, and then down to even some local police departments. So that's kind of a high level overview of what we're talking about and a little bit of meta information of how we came to be here.
Sure. So, yeah, I have mixed feelings about all this.
Yeah, I mean, I hope almost everyone does. Like, I certainly do.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm just old enough that I want things, and maybe it's because I'm also politically somewhat conservative. Like, I want to have as much privacy as I can be afforded. Yet that being said, I'm not doing anything that I don't care if sees the light of day. So I guess I also am maybe just young enough that I don't have any real expectation of privacy either. And I guess I'm fine with the government seeing just how boring my life is if it reduces the likelihood that, that, you know, crimes are committed, especially of a terrorist kind of nature, but even of a more benign nature, but still bad. I don't know. I guess that's just where I fall.
Yeah. I don't know. So I think that there's a lot of, this is a really hard topic, you know, to talk about, because there's so many different, there's a lot of moving parts here. So I think, like, there's a whole bunch of different places where this conversation can go, right? We can talk about, you know, whether or not we have the expectation of privacy now, you know, that's arguable, yes or no. You know, we can talk about whether or not this company has sort of violated, if not laws, then at least sort of norms and expectations around how certain types of data are going to be used. You know, so data or information that I share publicly on the internet, you know, there's some nominal, you know, norm and expectation that, like, this will be maybe kept on one platform, or that it isn't going to be siphoned into a giant data set, you know, that'll be used to potentially identify me or anybody, you know, if they engage in, you know, appearing in public somewhere. You know, there's this whole idea of, you know, the sci-fi fantasy future that, you know, a lot of us have been sold or has been sort of put forth as a future wherein. So this was one of the neat things from, or neat slash terrifying things from the New York Times article that that some of the code that Clearview had written could facilitate integration with augmented reality glasses that would reveal the identity of a person that it nominally identified to the wearer of the goggles. Like, that is a version of the future that has been sold in a positive light, right? You know, the idea of never having to remember people's, you know, names that you may have only met once or twice at a business meeting or a conference, but being able to see, you know, a little bubble above their, you know, digitally displayed over their, you know, over their head through some glasses, like, oh, this is John Smith, and you met him at the, you know, some engineering conference or whatever. You know, there's so many different ways that we could start with this. So, you know, where do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that there's, like, a lot of different implications here. Yeah, I don't know that I've got a preference on kind of where to start. I think that it's I think that it's very interesting to think about this. And I guess my personal belief, and again, going back to our episode a couple weeks ago, my personal belief is that this, like, the world we live in will be this and will be that. What you just said, at least your own kind of past meetings will be tracked, but more than likely, it'll even identify strangers walking down the street, which, again, I think is probably scary in a lot of ways. But I just think, and the founder of the company, whose name I would not be good at pronouncing, but Hone, I think, is his first name. you know, I think references like that he thinks this is the best use of the technology. But again, whether it is or isn't the best use of the technology, it's my belief that we will live in a world where that is commonplace.
Why though? Through, and why is it inevitable?
I don't know. Maybe I've seen too many movies, you know.
That everything's just going to turn into Minority Report. And, yeah, you know, it'll be like, thank you, Mr. Anderson. You know, if you want true anonymity once again, you'll have to switch out your eyeballs for somebody else.
I guess so. I mean, you know, and obviously Minority Report's not the only movie where there's I don't know that that's exactly dystopian, but let's just call it where there's a dystopian future like that. You know, I mean, but look, there's also startups that aren't, I don't know if specifically trying to work on identifying you by eyeball scans, but are trying to work on being able to beam different things into your eyes versus mine. So if we're in the same room and we look in the same direction, we see different things.
To
customize advertising. Well, I mean, yeah, assuming they can do that without hurting your eyeballs and anyways.
No. I'm not even saying that. I'm saying it's not good from the perspective of like if we all have a consensus reality and we're able to, and some people are able to, using technology, manipulate what consensus reality is by showing different types of things to different people, even in the same room, right? Wherein like, you know, it's like that phrase from 1984, which again, not to bring all like the baggage of that into it, but like, you know, what are you going to believe? Are you going to believe, you know, something, or are you going to believe your own lying eyes? Right. Like,
absolutely. I mean, and so I don't know why I think it's an inevitability. I guess, again, part of me hopes it's not, but it just seems like regulation often is slow to catch up to technology. And I think that it's unlikely that the technology won't outpace regulation, even if they strictly stay within what's allowable today. And regulation won't catch up fast enough to have a practical application. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if under certain lens that you looked at some of the way that this information is being used as a violation of the amendment against unlawful like search and seizure, you know, so that's one of the, you know, constitutional amendments. So, you know, I don't know. Now that they reference that they've got attorneys who have reviewed this, and I guess that's fine. Again, I'm not worried about hiding myself from the police, but I guess I would also rather it not be known where I was at any point in time, especially if it's as simple as, you know, any security camera footage seeing me that gets knowledge of where I'm located. I mean, obviously Google, Facebook, you know, Verizon Wireless all already know where I am, and I'm, I guess, comfortable with that because it's impractical for them not to in today's world, just to, you know, use a cell phone and GPS. But having any member of the public, possibly in an eventual future, but most, if not all, law enforcement agencies able to see where I am also is not something I'd prefer to be possible.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a lawyer here, but it's my understanding that if you want to get somebody's location from their cell phone provider, you have to subpoena those records unless they were otherwise, you know, on some sort of list that pre-authorizes you to continue tracking where those folks are. This is a situation where given some footage or given an image, again, based on my reading of this article, given an image, say from security camera footage, you can take the face of the person in the footage and with some level of accuracy, right? It's clearly beyond just like statistical, like random noise, you know, from a identification standpoint, but you can just sort of like show an image and it'll surface like, okay, well, here's a couple of people or a set of people that this might end up being. Right. And it's not just information from previous offenders. Right. For example, a database of mugshots or even a database of people who have like driver's license pictures, which obviously not everybody who has a driver's license is some sort of isn't not everybody who has a driver's license or has a state ID is a criminal. But like you know, having this like vastly more enriched data set, you know, seems like there could be some sort of a slippery slope there.
I agree.
But to
flip the script a little bit, yeah. I think that there's a good side of that too, right? Like in the article, there were several references to individuals who the police would not have otherwise been able to identify or catch. There was a specific reference of someone who wasn't a licensed driver and had never been arrested as an adult, so was in no database, but who committed a crime. And, you know, because of that, the police were able to, in about 20 seconds, identify that individual. And then I don't know how, but we're somehow able to then go find that person and arrest them. So, I mean, I guess that's certainly good. And that person would appear in none of their local, state, or federal databases if those databases only contained images of previously arrested adult offenders and licensed drivers. I don't know if it's any kind of crime not to have a state ID if you are not a licensed driver.
I don't know.
I guess that's an interesting question.
I'm not.
Yeah, I don't know.
But
so, I mean, that's the other side is, I guess I support this insofar as it doesn't infringe on people's personal, personal freedoms. But I don't know, like, how do you draw the line between those two things?
I don't see how it doesn't somehow infringe on somebody's personal freedom. For example, like, I know based on. Now, granted, grant me the following. Things may have changed since then. But I took a photography class in high school, which I swear is relevant here. And we were given a assignment to do some street photography and specifically to take pictures of people on the street, which obviously if you're, you know, a 16-year-old kid with a, you know, with a camera, at least in around 2006, when I was taking this class, I was specifically told that, like, if you're out in public, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy, right? That much I understand. I understand that,
right,
that an individual, e.g. some high school kid taking a photography class, has the right to go out and take people's pictures in public and do with them effectively what they want, because being in public, you sacrifice some amount of expectation of privacy. What I think those laws have not necessarily taken into account is the power that comes from being able to aggregate all of that information into a big database and then being able to cross-check, you know, a picture that may have been captured of you while you were in public against that database. And for me, at least, having the knowledge that this can be done makes me much less willing to go out and, for example, advocate for things that I very strongly believe in. If there is a protest at some point in the future for an issue that I care a lot about, I know that there's laws around wearing masks, but like I will probably end up wearing it again. If there's a protest for a thing that I really believe in, and I choose to go, I will go in makeup because I don't want to have my image sucked into some sort of, you know, law enforcement database, you know, because I have the ability, because I'm exercising my free speech rights at a protest.
Yeah. So again, I mean, and that's the second, I guess, kind of thing to think about in terms of actual constitutionally provided freedoms. I mean, through the amendments, obviously, but that's now the second, I think, amendment that this has potential to cause a problem with.
Yeah.
So I think, again, I would argue that our modern legal system and infrastructure is not set up to be as caught up as technology
right.
is and cannot move by its design, not by necessity, but by its current design. Our legal system is not designed in such a way, I don't think, that it's ready to catch up with changes like this and the speed at which changes like this could move or not could, are moving, you know, in today's society.
Right.
And I'm sure the average person doesn't think about that, right? I mean, I've heard exactly what you've heard, not from high school photography class, but I've heard like, look, if you leave your house, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy when you're, you know, in a public place, walking down the street, you know, walking into a publicly available building or mall or other venue. And that, like, I get that. That makes sense to me. But yeah, it's interesting to think about, because you also probably don't expect that people are, as you said, that your picture is going to be aggregated into a database and compared to the other places you've been and contextualized in the way that it now could be with information sources like this.
Right. Right. This is not the sort of thing that you can, you know, reasonably expect people to give informed consent about, right? Like someone who shares their photos publicly on Facebook, right? Which is as stated in the article, a primary source of these photos. You know, somebody who shares that stuff on Facebook should not also be assumed, or it shouldn't be assumed that they also understand that sharing their photo publicly on Facebook also means that it can get siphoned into some data set that will be used by a company, or it doesn't even matter it's a company, right? But the ultimate end is to be used as a data tool by police and government and law enforcement services. It's a really slippery slope.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess it would also be interesting to understand the use cases of a lot of companies. They made reference in the article to that several companies, several non-law enforcement, organizations were using it for what I assume would be commercial purposes. Again, I could see tons of ways. I mean, it seems like the internet's creepy enough in the way it retargets you and the way that cookie information is tracked and shared, and that you visit one website, you know, look at one specific thing you might just be thinking about buying or doing research on. And then, of course, the ads across every website that you use are filled with, hey, Jason, do you really want to buy that thing that you looked at yesterday?
And then I'll say no, because I already bought my slippers. I don't need to see slippers from, you know, eight other slipper purveyors, you know, across the web. But Graham, like, that's the thing that facial recognition can facilitate, which is being able to track a person. Like, imagine the following. So Graham, you and I were both, you know, recording this from, you know, our respective corners of Chicago, right?
Yes.
Imagine somebody.
Both of us are at our homes today.
Yeah. So imagine somebody, you know, walking down Michigan Avenue, which for people who are not based in Chicago is sort of like the main commercial drag, retail, you know, drag in Chicago, right? So you got your big department stores, you got smaller shops, but it's a nice shopping street. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, literally called the Magnificent Mile. I live near the north end of it. You live kind of near the south end of that mile.
Sure.
Approximately.
I'm not going to disclose my location.
Yeah, we don't have to go too far into OPSEC here.
No. But like imagine what a future is, you know, walking into, you know, the Bloomingdale's building at 900 North, having just, you know, gotten back from Water Tower Place, and, you know, you see a billboard at the Bloomingdale's that says, oh, hey, Graham, you know, you might, we saw you hanging out in the shoe department in Macy's at Water Tower Place. You know, why don't you check out the men's shoes department at Bloomingdale's? We have.
We'll give you 20% off.
That's exactly right.
If you buy shoes today here.
Right. So on the one hand, you can say that the most pernicious thing that is happening here is people are just trying to sell you stuff and that you have the ability to say no, right? Like, I feel as though, and perhaps incorrectly, that I have the self-control to look at the third purveyor of slippers on some display ad and say, not today. I already have my slippers. But, you know, what you're really getting to is whether or not you have any agency at all as a person in this economy. Because if everything ends up just getting funneled down and filtered down to you in particular, like, do you really have a choice then about where you're going to go buy your shoes, whether it's between Macy's and Bloomingdale's? And I know that this sounds like kind of a silly and contrived example, and it is, to be fair. But like,
because it is.
Right. But it also really matters because like, it then comes down to like, are you really making a decision about, you know, what type of food you're buying? Are you making a decision about what type of medical care you are going to end up seeking? Are you making a decision? Are you able to make, you know, a good choices about, you know, job hunting and stuff like that? Like,
and what if that information is shared with those various providers, right? If you choose a pair of slippers that doesn't support what your podiatrist suggests, does your insurance stop covering your podiatry?
Yeah, for my fat, spatulate feet. No, I'm saying,
again,
no,
I'm just going now too far in the shoe example.
No,
but
this is
but
a
seriously,
real
like,
thing.
If I don't walk, 10,000 steps a day, which I think is an arbitrary number anyway, and I do most days, by the way, for my insurance provider, does my health insurance cost go up?
Hold
if
up,
I don't
back it up.
Whoa, visit the whoa, gym whoa, at least back it three up. Times
Wait,
a week.
Stop it. Hold the phone. Graham, you walk 10,000 steps a day because that's what your health insurance provider wants you to do?
No, I think that's an arbitrary number that we've been told to do. But
wait, hold
no,
on. If you don't, let's make this concrete here. And if you want to abstract it away from yourself personally, feel free. Are you or somebody like you given a discount because you share your walking and your step data with your health insurance provider?
To be very clear, I don't share it with them in any way, shape, or form. I think that there's a world. I think that we're not a far distance from a world where your actions dramatically impact your choices, right? And there are real-time feedback loops that I think this type of facial recognition and AI could tie very closely into. Again, for example, you go into how many bars per month, if you're tracked going into them, maybe your health insurance cost goes up, right? Again, not me, just one,
right?
There are already not facial recognition platforms, but there are already either based on your phone and or other devices that plug into your car. There are real world driving insurance increases in rates and reductions in rates. And in fact, I've seen a new data-enabled driving insurance product that just says, we just don't insure bad drivers so that the cost of the insurance for the entire pool of drivers stays relatively low on a per driver basis because we don't want to insure bad drivers. And they make you install an app on your phone 2 to 4 weeks before you want to begin getting insurance by them. And then if you're a bad driver, they don't take you into their network. What I am postulating is that there is a version of the future where facial recognition and AI gives similar feedback loops to health insurance and other types of providers that you would not want it to about other of your actions, like your shopping habits, like your eating and drinking habits, like your exercise habits, that is part of a feedback loop you may not want it to be that will impact your cost of care and coverage for care and all kinds of other things along those lines.
And this
again,
I'm
just saying there are far reaching tentacles of some of these things when you actually think about the impact that they
and
may have.
And that's why I am and this is a, you know, for the record statement here, right? as of today, you know, January 19th, 2020, I, Jason Rowley, would be a strong advocate for a moratorium on public use of facial recognition technology until we have better regulations, regulations in place, a better understanding of how this affects society in place, because this is one of those things that once you open Pandora's box, you are not going to be able to put all the Furies back in. And
it will be really hard to put the toothpaste back in that tube, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a thing that if we want, and this is, again, my own sort of pontificating and beliefs and biases here, but if we want to be able to, like, be somewhat independent operators in the world, the very least that we should be able to do is maintain some sort of ability to move in physical space with some degree of anonymity if we so choose. Does that enable people who might want to do bad things to do bad things and reduce their likelihood of getting caught? Yes, it does. 100%. I'm not saying it doesn't. But, like, in order to stop the very tiny minority of bad actors out there, is it worth it for all of us to sacrifice this type of privacy? And my answer is, at least personally, no.
Yeah. I mean, I think overall I agree with that. I'm just reminded of my favorite show of all time is The West Wing. And I'm just reminded of a scene from its first episode, which I just rewatched yesterday, coincidentally, with a friend who had never seen the show before. And there are these religious leaders who visit the White House, and there had been some tension with them and their group before. And the first scene of the entire series where Martin Sheen, the president, actually is in it, which is not until near the end of the first episode, the religious leaders are asking if pornography is available for $5 on every street corner. Is that too high a cost for having freedom of speech? And the president said, absolutely not. He does go on to say, I think that's too high a cost for pornography, but I think that that's absolutely the cost of free speech, is having things like that available. And I think this is an extension of that exact same kind of argument. And I completely agree with you that while you shouldn't have the expectation of complete anonymity from, again, your picture being taken by someone as you walk down the street, you shouldn't assume that any particular person walking by you can know who you are, what you do for a living, possibly other,
how much money you make,
again,
whether or not you have cancer, like, there's all sorts of shit that,
where you live,
pardon my French, but yeah, like this is a deep, dark rabbit hole that I don't think that, okay. So if you take this sort of, like, maybe Mark Zuckerberg has sort of evolved his position on this, but if you take, like, an old school Zuckerbergian, you know, sort of take, and you say that in a world of perfect transparency, you know, you remove a lot of the need for, like, trust, right? And by proxy, you have, in a world without privacy, you instead have everybody being effectively compelled to be a good actor. Yeah, I don't know. Just doesn't. I don't know where I was going with that. I said the thing, but I.
Well, it's really interesting because Google obviously had a mantra for a long time of, you know, don't be evil, right? And they've since kind of abandoned that, but it's really interesting because the article references a former chairman or CEO, I believe they're talking about Eric Schmidt in this case, saying that basically the only thing that they ever actively prohibited all, you know, kind of Google business units from doing was almost exactly this. Like, they basically just said, this technology has so many far-reaching implications that we don't understand yet, that we will do all kinds of things and develop new technologies that do all sorts of different things. And this is basically, it didn't say that it was literally the only thing, but it was one of the few things that they actively prohibited Google employees from building platforms that went in this direction, because they just didn't have a good feeling about how it would turn out, is what the article seemed to say.
Yeah.
Again, I'm paraphrasing and stacking a little bit
but
more
on top. I think they're right, because I don't see a way that this ends. Like, if you look at the end state of... If you look at like the end state of like facial recognition technology, it's not a world that I necessarily really want to live in, right? I don't want to walk into a grocery store and be like, and have it and have a sign that says, "Jason, your blueberries are, you know, 8 days old in your fridge and you might want fresh blueberries." I'm like, "Well, thank you very much. I just don't want blueberries this week." like I don't I that's a I mean, and that's a silly example, but it gets to more material things too. Like, I don't want to have to second guess going to, not even like a protest. I'm saying, like, I don't want to have to second guess going to a political rally. We're in the middle of an election year, right? Like, I wouldn't want to go to a political rally and know that there's a high likelihood that my being there would be captured on as a photo, and to have years from now, let's say I go to a political rally and years from now, you know, the person that I the candidate that I went to turns out to be some sort of like raging, you know, some like very unhinged, terrible, you know, person who advocates for, you know, I don't know, like the worst possible sets of things that you could possibly imagine. I'm not saying this is the case with any, you know, current political candidates today. I'm just giving a very ridiculous example. Like if that person just, if that politician had changed their sets of beliefs really, you know, radically, do I still ever want my previous association with that political candidate to be known publicly? No, I don't. I want the anonymity of being able to go and see things and do things in large groups of people and feel as though there's a certain safety in numbers, which does not exist in this in an environment where absolutely everything that you do is captured and run through some sort of a recognition thing and all the rest, because that starts looking suspiciously like a social credit score system or other sorts of things that aren't, at least in my mind, conducive with the sort of world view that is, you know, that made America, you know, sort of what it is, as ostensibly, at least as far as its branding goes, you know, a place of some freedom and opportunity and all the rest.
Yeah.
It's not good.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I guess I've been thinking for the last few seconds about, you know, again, I said earlier and have said many times, both on this podcast and even more times to you and others in real life, that I'm, you know, politically relatively conservative. And one of the reasons that I am that way is that I believe that government should be small and generally believe in less regulation and the allowance for free markets to take care of things. But I think that this, and I'm finding an increased number of times when that's not what that doesn't align with my end belief on a specific issue. And I think this is one of those times, because as much as I would love to see, in many ways, what would be a big advocate of businesses, would actually like to fund businesses in certain circumstances that had data like this, you know, as their backbone. Again, not in any specific instance. I don't want to fund a healthcare institution that takes all that data into account and then, you know, increases or decreases your health insurance cost. But again, I see a lot of commercial applications that are very valid for this kind of thing. But I think at the end of the day, I fall down on the side of this is something where additional government regulation is necessary before before facial recognition AI is allowed in mass to be used for commercial or government purposes, at all. Even noting that that increases the risks of certain edge cases of things for the general public as a whole, I would prefer until there is an increased understanding of the way these technologies work. And don't work, by the way. Several times throughout the article, they make note that there is no double check against false positives and some other things. But putting that aside and the specifics aside, I think until there is increased understanding of how things like this work and regulation around what is and is not allowable in terms of the use of data like this, I would personally prefer that things like what Clearview is doing, not them specifically, but things like that, not be allowed to exist in the world or happen.
I mean, look, we know how these things work, right? From a technical standpoint, first off, I'm not like a machine learning engineer or whatever. But from a technical standpoint, you're just gathering a giant corpus of data and then building a statistical model that uses like edge detection and a couple of other, you know, probably some fun stuff to, you know, say within a certain level of confidence that, okay, this particular set of angles in this particular face, you know, matches the model of this particular face that was gathered from all sorts of other, you know, data gathered from Facebook and Venmo and other sorts of sources that this company has gotten its stuff from. Like, that we know how it works. What we have yet to figure out as a society, and this comes back to the whole you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube thing, is how this fundamentally changes our society. Because, like, we've let, and I say this, like, largely as a beneficiary of this, like, you know, we've let large technology companies sort of make their own social experiment of our society, and to an extent they've won, right? Like 20 years ago, people were not actively posting all their, you know, cat photos alongside their political beliefs, alongside their pictures of dinner on Facebook. Although Facebook isn't exactly a cat photo sharing venue, but you know what I mean, right? Like Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, all these like really big companies out there are radically changing our sort of like, and I'm saying like this as people, as citizens, as like individuals, as part of a collective group, changing the way that we relate to one another and how we relate to those in power. And that doesn't necessarily just mean the, you know, a big scary government that can lock you in jail for, you know, going to a political rally, but it could also be a retailer that just really freaking wants you to buy their shoes. Like, you know, it's,
what is it with you and shoes and slippers today?
I don't know.
It's a good demonstrative example
because in this case it's something that's like very silly and very like basic and fairly innocuous, right?
Right. But it proves the point. Yep.
Right.
I'm right there with you.
Sure. I mean, I could have said shoes. I could have said. Trying to think of something else sitting around here. Coffee mugs. I don't care. Like,
sure.
Like that's a thing that we all have to know. And or it's a thing that would have to be explored. But the thing is that there's no natural experiment, you know, where there exists a world where in the US or in a sort of quote unquote, and this I know could be problematic depending on how you read the following, but like, you know, quote unquote Western cultures, you know, there isn't a world where this technology exists in huge scale in the US or Europe or South America or whatever. It does exist in China.
I was going to say, without jumping off onto an entirely other subject, although it's closely related to some of what we've talked about and may even have been part of the kind of reference of a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I think this does exist in mass in China already. And that's one of the, you know, but obviously they live in while it seems like there are increasingly capitalistic tendencies of the way their society operate, they still live in a government controlled communist society. So I think that's fundamentally different from the way that the government by design and by necessity is supposed to work here in the United States. And exactly as you said, you know, there are very specific things that we expect to be able to enjoy as freedoms here that I think this is one of the very things that is nearest kind of the unwinding of some of those exact freedoms, depending upon how this how and by whom this information is used moving forward.
Yeah.
And that is scary to me on again, a fundamental societal level.
Yeah. So here's the thing that, because I don't really have all that much else to say apart from the following, which is that this is a really, at least in my opinion, this Clearview thing, which we didn't really mention, but it is venture-backed, particularly like Peter Thiel and others have invested in this. I've seen some mention all over VC Twitter that, you know, oh, we saw this deal, but we decided to pass for various reasons. And everybody's been really self-congratulating about it. I'm happy for the people that that chose to pass on this deal. And Peter Thiel, you know, first backer of Facebook, co-founder of Palantir, this is very on brand for him to have backed. But the thing that I want our listeners to take away from this is a thing I've been thinking a lot about, which is that an early check from a venture capitalist or an angel investor, but anyways, an early investment check is like, it's a ballot cast in favor for a particular vision of the future. And this is just one person or one firm's vision of what a future could look like. The good news is that it doesn't have to be like this. And other investors out there, you know, may be able to invest in other things that run counter to the particular narrative that certain other investors might be trying to push, that this sort of world is inevitable, and that, you know, and that there is no choice but to fund the companies that are at least nominally, according to, you know, the founder of Clearview, they're trying to do this in the best way possible. That it doesn't have to be that way, and that you can opt to vote for a different future with your money, and that it doesn't have to be this way.
It's really interesting to think about, almost like a world of counter venture capital.
Oh my God, this would be
like amazing. like the people who, you know, every time a new laser gun or police detecting technology of the speed of your car comes out, then there's somebody who invests in a better way to counteract that type of technology.
Call it narrative violation like ventures or something.
Yeah, it's like an arms race, but on both sides. That's interesting to think about, venture that invests specifically counter to certain specific or even broad theses.
I mean, it'd be like a venture hedge fund, right? You know, it's like you see all the direction that some quote unquote smart money, you know, sees the world going, and then just saying like, yeah, that's BS. I really believe
in a different future, and I'm willing to invest in that future.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, back.
I just see your investment thesis and reappropriate it as my own.
Yeah, exactly.
And shove it back in your face.
But going back to the counterpoint, I think it would also be interesting. In the company, if you've removed either the ability to publicly share certain information or changed that information, like what pictures of you are available on the internet, Clearview does say that they will allow you to remove your data from the website, although they will keep a copy once it's been scraped. Interestingly, they're also keeping the data that the police are uploading, and many of the police don't didn't know that or don't know that. But, you know, I mean, I guess it's also interesting because I could see a version of the future if this technology does exist in mass, I guess at 3 billion pictures, arguably maybe it already does. But I could see a future where people, where there are venture-backed startups that don't specifically compete with or try to remove this as a thesis as a whole, but where that develop products that allow you or me specifically to opt out or receive protection, or our faces be blurred out automatically in every, you know, photo that we're in the background of or something. I don't know what that.
Yeah, I mean, like makers of like, you know, like face jamming, you know, like makeup or color or like color blocking stuff. Like the future will probably look very weird if this sort of thing comes into account, because I will personally walk around with a wacky hairstyle and crazy makeup all the time. Like
that assumes that you don't walk around already with a wacky hairstyle
or crazy makeup.
I've never seen you wear makeup, but you know, what you do in your time is your business, Jason.
And that's at least for now, Graham.
Right. Comfort of it.
I don't think there's going to be a better way to end a show other than that.
No, I think that works.
All right.
Well, everybody out there, stay private in your pictures. And if you're in Chicago, stay warm.
Indeed.